We're going to look at the scientific approach to thermal management. Our speaker is Jim Baum. He is with the Motorola Aerospace Center at Scottsdale, Arizona. Received a BME in 1952 and an MS in 1961. He has worked in the field of thermal design and packaging of electronic equipment for the past 12 years. He is presently the chief engineer of mechanical engineering laboratory at the Aerospace Center. And while Jim didn't add it, he has written many papers, and he has just recently co-authored with me and a number of others a new handbook of electronic packaging, which is in the process of final editing by McGraw-Hill. So this will be coming along within the next 8 to 10 months, or sooner, hopefully. Jim? Pardon? Let's see if we can get you tied in here.
Yeah, I guess. Cut
a couple of minutes.
Yeah, careful there with my time. Thanks, Jack.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be concerned the next few minutes with thermal design problems, as Jack told you. Now, you've heard a lot of new things and a lot of new devices discussed in the last couple of days, and I really would like to come here as the messiah of heat transfer and present some new and exotic things to you. Unfortunately, as I think I'll demonstrate this morning, things don't work exactly that way. Thermal problems really haven't changed a lot over the years. And we're going to be talking pretty much about the same kind of thermal design considerations we've talked about in the past. This in no way makes them any less important. So I'd like to illustrate with my first slide. Note that this is the only slide you've seen, I think, with a girl on it. Just a side issue there. The thermal problems are pretty common whether we're talking about people, missiles, equipment, integrated circuit, or even tubes, to use a dirty word. And we use pretty much the same approach in dealing with them. Our first job is to establish temperature limits, and everything has some kind of temperature limit. Indeed, she does too. The second thing we need to do is identify the location and the amount of heat dissipation that we're dealing with. We then need to define the environment we're trying to work in. And then we have a nice straightforward job. We need to simply provide some means of dissipating this heat in the environment we're trying to operate in and without exceeding the temperature limits. Seems like a reasonably straightforward problem. What I'd like to do here this morning is to first look at the devices themselves, and we'll get inside and look at them a little bit from a thermal standpoint. Then we're going to look a little bit at equipment in total. And then finally, we'll delve a little bit into the future and see what tomorrow's problems may bring us. Now, before we go any further, I'd like to have a little capsule review of the principles of heat transfer. There'll be a little shudder here, and you can say, well, why? Well, it's been my experience that thermodynamics was not everybody's favorite subject, and there's almost a resistance to listening when people talk about it, so at least I'd like to be using the same language that we want to talk about. We're talking, in general, gentlemen, in electronic equipment, of three modes of heat transfer: conduction, radiation, and convection. I think you're familiar with the basic phenomena involved. What I'd like to do here is talk about their relative efficiency, if you want to use that kind of a term. I've tried to show this on this slide by talking about a flat pack integrated circuit. We're dissipating 1 watt in that circuit. We have a 32 degree F or 0 degree F sink to go to, and the modes of heat transfer is indicated. The top one, by radiation only. Typical of a space environment, if you want to suspend that microcircuit by a thread, 300 degrees C case temperature one might see under those conditions. Typical room temperature situation, combination of convection and radiation, we're down around 140 degrees C. 140 degrees C per watt, a number some of you may recognize as a derating factor for case temperatures on some devices of this size. And finally, conduction. And I've been conservative here in that there's a little bit of contact resistance and a long aluminum rod in there. Never mind the numbers. I don't want to argue with you about those in detail. Look at those magnitudes. Considerable difference in the approach there as far as the resultant temperature rises. The message is clear. In general, in equipment, if you're looking for high density, you look for conduction cooling. And what does conduction cooling mean? It means you try to provide reasonably large sections, reasonably short paths of good thermal conductivity material. Notice that these are somewhat incompatible with some of the packaging approaches that one sees not only here in previous discussion, but elsewhere. Consequently, we do have some thermal problems to talk about. So with, at least we're talking now, I hope, the same language, I'd like to go ahead and consider the devices themselves. And when we talk about the devices, it's very convenient to really simplify the world and talk about things in terms of the electrical, so-called electrical thermal analogy, where we talk about current being proportional to heat flow, voltage potential being proportional to temperature difference, and that leaves us with a neat concept of something called thermal resistance, typically expressed in degrees C per watt. And indeed, we'll use that for our discussion. And I'll lump all the modes of heat transfer from point A to point B together, because in general there's one predominant mode, and especially in devices, it's conduction, and we'll talk about a kind of a lump parameter approach. As this slide illustrates here, we, for the typical type of devices, conventional devices, we have kind of a series resistance situation. We have a resistance within the chip itself. We call this an inter-chip resistance. We have a resistance associated with a bond between the chip and the header, and as I'm going to show, this is a finite resistance from a thermal standpoint. Then we have an intra-case resistance, and we'll discuss this a little bit. And then finally, we have some external resistance where we go from the case of the device out to the rest of the world. Let me bring up another little pet peeve here quickly, and that's the term sink, which everybody uses without regard to the various meanings. When I talk about a heat sink, I'm talking about the ultimate heat sink, at least the ultimate sink for any particular equipment we're talking about, where the question is, where is the heat finally going? When I'm talking about going between the heat source and this ultimate sink, I'm talking about thermal paths. So let me go on from there, and let's look at these intra-case paths or resistances, as the case may be. When we talk about what's going on inside the chip, we can talk pretty much about what's called a spreading resistance concept. Here we have a bunch of individual dissipators on the top of a chip which don't take up the entire chip area. I think you're familiar with this from your own potential theory. The picture here shows a nice, neat, uniform dissipation across the top of the chip, one-dimensional heat transfer, short paths, no gradients, no lateral gradients in the chip. What happens over here? Small dissipators, lateral gradients in the chip, longer paths. We definitely have gradients within the chip. Now, let me just say here, in summary of the chip gradient problem, that there certainly are measurable gradients, that you can see them. You need to be concerned about them if you have circuitry which needs to be closely matched from a thermal standpoint. Silicon chips have very high thermal conductivities, very close to aluminum, as a matter of fact, and this does make the problem easier. But for high dissipation devices and sensitive devices, it is a matter of concern. Let me just show on my next slide here what the result of some analysis that one might make for a given size chip, where we're looking at the actual intra-chip resistance. That is the temperature rise between this point and this point per watt of dissipation in the dissipator as a function of this effective dissipator diameter or size. Notice what the curve does. It, as you increase the size of the dissipator, as you might expect, the resistance drops off. But very importantly, it levels off. And this level off occurs considerably smaller size than the top of the chip itself, or the entire chip size. Now the message here is that you don't have to have a dissipator that covers the whole top of the chip to have a minimum thermal resistance. There's another message, and that is that if you have a bunch of dissipators and you put them far enough apart that you're down on this part of the curve with them, then they won't know the other one is there. And this may be a very valuable concept to you if you have some local heat sources and maybe some passive components that you're a little bit concerned about getting warm. Let's go on, then, and talk about the next resistance that we see, the next gradient area that we see, and I'll just leave this slide on for a moment because that exists down here at this bond line. Now, let me just summarize this situation by saying bond thermal resistance may be the most significant thermal resistance you have to deal with today. This resistance occurs even with the best bonding techniques and the best material combinations that we've been able to see. The average off-the-shelf unit today, bonding silicon chips to a metallized or metallic header by a gold diffusion bond or gold eutectic bond, gives numbers like 0.05 degrees C inch squared per watt. Never mind remembering that number. The best we've been able to do, and we think anybody else has been able to do, is down around 0.02. So we aren't making any tremendous strides so far in reducing this number. Now, translated into real life, for a 50 by 50 mil chip, this number looks like 20 degrees C per watt. And as we'll see in a moment, that can be a big part of the overall thermal resistance in the device. Die bond thermal resistance is something we're going to have to do some work on. The thing that's really bad about it is that it's subject to so much variance. The 3 sigma variation in any experimental measurement of, say, 100 units is anywhere from 3 to 5 to 10 to 1. And this makes it pretty difficult sometimes to try to design a device for high thermal dissipation and low thermal resistance. Let's go on, then, and look at the last thermal resistance one might be concerned with in a device. And I've used this because I didn't have a better picture, but it shows the, I hope, will demonstrate the problem associated with distribution of the heat from the chip itself. This is a typical quarter-by-quarter flat pack, a somewhat archaic design. But we've got this, again, a local heat source in the middle of this big substrate, and we're trying to distribute the heat either into the bottom or all over in the substrate. The result, then, is that we have another spreading resistance problem. Spreading resistance, again, is a function of thickness and materials, the material thermal conductivity, and so here we have a material selection situation. Obviously, metal cases are better than ceramic cases, which are better than glass cases, and we're going to be concerned with this sort of thing. Now, we have one exception to the rules here, or a little bit of an exception to what I've been discussing, and that's the so-called plastic package, because there is an all-encapsulated package, and it's kind of hard to identify this nice, simple, one-dimensional relationship that I've been showing here between the chip and the bond and the header. So in the plastic package, we have essentially the a bulk effect situation, and we're now concerned mainly with the thermal conductivity of material. Now, plastics are rotten thermal conductors, let's face it. The only saving grace we have in this whole business is the fact that we have a lot of material to work with and a lot of area. So we're going to be concerned as we talk about plastic packages and using them for higher dissipation devices and some means of getting that heat out, either higher thermal conductivity plastics or else actual metal heat sinks within the devices themselves. And this indeed is what's being done. Let me summarize here. Let's look at some typical device designs here. Let's look at the overall thermal resistances of them. Flat packs, junction case, that's a local dissipator to some reference point on the outside of the case, 10 to 50 degrees C per watt. TO5 can, that's a terrible picture of a TO5 can, but so anyway, that's what it is. 40 to 80 degrees C per watt, dual inline plastic package, 20 to 60. Big overlaps. There's no clear-cut picture here. Always use one, don't use the other. In general, about 3 to 5 degrees C is in the chip itself. About 20 degrees C may be in some cases in the bond, depending on the situation, and the rest of it's in the case itself. The flat packs look especially good because we bond, usually bond these down directly right beneath the chip. So we have a real short intra-case resistance. Biggest problem in devices is a lack of definitive data. Manufacturers don't test the same, those that do test. Data reporting is terrible, so you really don't know what you have. And if you're using your own cases, you're in even worse shape. EIA committees are trying to do something about standardizing on this, and I think we'll see an improvement in the future in this regard. So much for devices for the moment. Let's talk about equipment. Why don't you take that slide off if you can? We won't need it for a minute. Jack set this one up pretty neatly in a number of ways for me, because first he showed 40 kinds of varieties of equipment, and I can't discuss them all. So rather than try to generalize, I'm going to pick out two areas of, I'll call it commonality, between equipments, two features which we see in almost every kind of equipment that we're going to deal with, and we'll talk about their thermal characteristics. And the first one of these is a printed circuit board. Can you go back to the one before this? Let's talk about the printed circuit boards we're with on every piece of equipment that almost has been talked about. And in many cases, this is the major link. The printed circuit board is the major link between the devices themselves and the rest of the world. What I've tried to show here is the results of a considerable amount of study that we've done, and it's very clear-cut. How much copper is on the board controls how good a conductor the board is. And indeed, a board can be an extremely effective thermal pad. This represents uniform dissipation, edge mounting, those temperature rises or resistances are from the center of the board to the edge. Notice the difference between 100% copper and a typical track on the other side. See what you can do, for example, in a multi-layer board by the use of a ground plane. The next slide shows what you can do by just paying a little bit of attention to leave some extra copper on the board. Just etch away where the tracks are. This is really important in space equipment, where the only way you're going to transfer that heat is by conduction, and you really don't want to have a lot of extra metal that you don't use for anything else in there. It's a very effective approach for a reasonable power density. This slide presents a natural lead-in to the next area of discussion, which has to do with the fact that we're running into more and more levels of modular subassembly. Now, as a natural setup here, Jack's first discussion showed that he torpedoed one of his designs there, the high-density volumetric module, mostly on the basis of the thermal design. Now, he pointed out that he wouldn't really allow it to operate there, but the fact remained in the trade-off study, that was shot down because there didn't seem to be a clear-cut way to get the heat out of the module. When you put modules in, you do two things. You've got another thermal path between the device and the outside world. That's, I think, fairly clear-cut, and these are rotten thermal paths usually, plastics, all the rest of that stuff. And secondly, the power density goes way up, which gives you a worse problem from the standpoint of just dissipating the heat in the area you have available. Now, what can you do about all of this? Well, there are a number of things you can do, one of which is you can talk about high thermal conductivity potting materials. At best, there aren't any. You can buy them. You go out to the show here, and they'll show you high thermal conductivity. What they mean is they're higher than if you don't do anything. But they're not high, and they're a real miserable thing to work with. Anybody who's tried to use a beryllium-filled epoxy on a high-density module knows what I'm talking about. So if that's all you can do, that's all you can do. A more straightforward, although not a very pretty approach, I'll try to lead into through the next slides here. I'm sorry about the low light level here, but the module you saw on that previous board, those series of long gray modules, this is the inside of one, and it holds 20 flat packs, 10 on each side here, and there's a bunch of printed flexible wiring in here. And this thing, if you talk about the maximum temperature rise and thermal resistance of it, looks like about 300 degrees C per watt from something in here out to some outside reference point. This is totally unacceptable for any kind of real high reliability equipment or high power density equipment. What can you do about it? Well, here's an approach, final answer, but it's the type of approach that is necessary. We simply added down the center of that module, and I've stripped away all the flat packs which would normally go here, a metal bar. This is hardly advancing the state of the art, but it provides a thermal resistance down around 10 degrees C per watt, a 30-to-1 reduction. Flat packs glued directly to this, circuitry's over the outside. This is the kind of approach that's going to be necessary if we're going to cope with the high-density thermal problems as far as modules are concerned. Now, this doesn't hardly tell you how to design your equipment for good thermal design, and as I said, I was going to beg that question because I didn't see how I was going to cover the 45 aberrations of equipment that we could discuss here. But I think you note the common type of elements that we've talked about, and I think you've noted the same rules are pretty much carry all the way through. And we're looking for conductive paths, and we're looking for ways to put them in. And we look for those at the beginning, not at the end. Now, what are we going to see in the future? We've seen a proliferation of devices. We've seen a proliferation of different configurations. Where are we going from a thermal standpoint? The first thing that is not going to happen is we are not going to get rid of the heat transfer people. Now, I had people tell me when transistors took over from tubes that you can shut your door there, we need you no longer. Power densities are down, transistors are solid-state devices, we have no thermal problems. I think you all recognize it didn't go that way. Then integrated circuits came along, digital integrated circuits, 30 milliwatts and a little flat pack, and the same message came through. Fellas, you're out of business again. We EEs will solve our problems, and there are no thermal problems. Well, we're still here, and I think I've demonstrated there's some problems. Now, they're going to get worse. Gentlemen, they are going to get worse. We're going to see linear integrated circuits, analog circuits, more and more of them, higher and higher powers. We're going to see microwave integrated circuits. And these, in general, will dissipate power. We're going to see all kinds of strange solid-state devices, which really come under microelectronics. We're doing some work in acoustic amplifiers with power densities that, if I juggle the areas right, look somewhere like the power density on the surface of the sun. And if... You try talking to one of the physicists that developed one of these things about putting a conductive heat sink into a quartz coupled or whatever the terminology is, acoustic amplifier, and it's pretty funny. So we're going to see this kind of thing. We're going to be more and more concerned on an individual level with what goes on inside these devices. We're going to be doing more and more hybrid work, and you aren't going to be able to sit back and read the manufacturer's inadequate data sheet and console yourself that there's nothing you can do about it, because you're going to be called upon to decide how much power, how many chips, and what kind of can size you should be using. Now, this is going to carry through, I think, in the fact that we're all going to be more and more concerned with the details involved. Another thing that's going to happen is, and we're seeing this already, is we're seeing all kinds of new device configurations. That's never going to stop. Things like flip chips. Any of you sat through some of the talks that have been given have heard people say things like, and in low voices, flip chips from a thermal standpoint appear to be all right because it looks like we're going to have enough pad area to transfer the heat, or we have to look into the thermal areas in flip chips. We don't know really where we stand. Well, this is true. We don't know where we stand, and there's a considerable amount of work to be done in this particular regard. Now, let me point out here that the overall approach I've taken here is a pretty gross approach, and if there are any heat transfer people in the audience, they're shuddering that anybody takes such a broad brush treatment. The only method of really handling the details of looking at the inside of a chip or the inside of a device or even the inside of equipment is by some pretty detailed and reasonably sophisticated thermal analysis techniques. And these techniques are available. I put in a plug for the people that are doing them at your companies. They have them at their fingertips. It doesn't do a bit of good if you don't go in and talk to them about them. The world's best computer approach is no good unless it looks at a reasonably current problem. So what are the conclusions that one might come to after the little bit of discussion we've had here on today's thermal problems? Well, first is that today's thermal problems are yesterday's and the day before yesterday's. I could have given the same talk with a little change in configuration about vacuum tubes or resistors or the signal core microcircuits or whatever you can. And indeed, they are the same traditional problems that we've had in the past. Find out where the heat sources are and how big they are. Find out what the temperature limits of your components are. Be able to understand and define your environment and try to provide a legitimate design that fits in with the rest of the mechanical design of the package. The biggest thing I think we're going to have to be concerned with, as I said before and I'll say again, is attention to details. We are not going to be able to pass off the fact that, gee, a dye bond looks like it's all right. After all, it gives us good thermal or good electrical contact. It doesn't have any thermal problems associated with it. We aren't going to get away with it. And believe me, I want to re-echo the point that Jack made in general at the end of his talk about packaging, and that is that the potentials available to us in microelectronics as far as reliability and packaging density and all the rest of the things, we're never going to realize those unless we concern ourselves with the details of packaging, and my particular detail that I'm hawking here today is thermal design. If we don't look at the thermal design, we're never going to realize the full potential of microcircuitry. Thank you.